Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. William Lager, the businessman and founder of the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, made a rare public appearance last week at a statehouse rally to support the online charter school. Still, the state has ordered ECOT to return $60 million because it cannot prove that students have been actively enrolled or actively engaged in learning. Lager and ECOT supporters say the move puts their school at risk. A school, he says, provides a valuable alternative. It's time for our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Ohio Statehouse reporter for Gatehouse Media, Mark Kovac. Welcome back, Mark.
Good morning.
Correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff. Welcome back, Laura.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back, Jackie.
Good morning.
Okay, so what's the deal with ECOT? It's had this rally. You just said that they really haven't had anything go their way so far in this process.
Right. So they had a big rally at the State House, hundreds, close to 1,000 people estimated to come, students, parents, teachers. William Lager got up and told a pretty, personal story about why he started the school that had to do with his stepdaughter. And, they got some positive press for probably for once in the last couple of years. And then 2 days later, the state hearing officer had issued his decision in the administrative hearing portion of this dispute, saying that ECOT owes the state $60 million for the disputed enrollment figures. And they had this small little rally at the state house, kind of this little win, and then a loss handed to them in this dispute.
When we were first hearing about this a year and a half or so ago, the number 128 million was being bandied about. Right? Is this just the 60 million for 1 year?
It's for 1 year.
For 1 year. Okay.
And I thought it was like 64 or 65 million, but they have a chance of reducing it to 60 million if they argue some provision or whatever. But it's a big chunk of change. It's a big chunk of change, and it's a big loss for ECOT. I'm sure that they're going to appeal it.
Now, last week when they had this rally, that was a school day, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, part of ECOT's, the pro of ECOT is that you can do your work when you need to do it. The students log into computers to do their work. The teachers work on a flexible schedules as well. And that's that came up in the planning for this because the superintendent of ECOT had sent some emails to teachers saying that it was mandatory for them to come to this rally. And then later, after the dispatch reported that, clarified that it was not mandatory, that it was encouraged, but no one would be, punished for not coming.
Mm-hmm. ECOT has made several complaints in its appeal on all of this. They're saying that it has been paid in the past for offering classes online to students without having to document their participation. What changed that made this an issue?
Well, there was a state, the Department of Education made a rule and applied it retroactively to gauge enrollment. And the original agreement, I think it dates back to 2003 or 2004, where they simply had to show, that they logged in. And then the department in this last round here said, well, no, actually, we want to see some evidence that they didn't just log into a computer, that they had some sort of learning going on, that they were in for hours, that to show that they were actually engaged in the program.
Politics wise, is this a big deal at the State House, Laura Bischoff?
Well, of course, Bill Lager is one of the main contributors to the House GOP caucus, has been for many years, and so a lot of the Democrats are pushing back, saying that he's had a free pass, that he's gotten his way for everything, ECOT is pushing back, saying, hey, it's not fair. We had a deal crafted back in 2003 or 2004, and you guys are changing the rules midstream. And it's all very interesting. I think the main thing that shouldn't be forgotten in all this is whether or not the kids are learning. I think online schools are probably a pretty good option for some students, for whatever reason. Going to a bricks and mortar school doesn't work for them. But I think that you know, there has to be accountability to make sure that students are learning, that they're covering the material, that it's not just a sign-on, or that we've provided these learning opportunities. I think somebody said it's, you know, it's almost like you wouldn't just teach to an empty classroom. So you have to actually make sure that the students are participating and learning.
It's a big school, right? 53,000, something like that?
Yeah, I think it's one of the largest. I mean, if we're a high school, it would be by far the largest high school in Ohio.
And it's not necessarily that successful.
No, I think their graduation rate is well below average. I mean, they'll argue that's because they're, you know, serving a population that's more challenging.
But that's a lot of charter schools, right?
Sure, it's a lot of charter schools. It's a lot of urban schools. But, yeah, they have a, you know, I wouldn't want to say the wrong number, but I think it's south of 50%.
I have a real hard time believing that these folks are ever going to be paying out this kind of money in the charter school friendly legislature that we have. You know, I just don't think it's. I mean, do you think that's going to happen? I mean, that's a big chunk of change to come up with.
But as Jackie said, they haven't had anything go their way yet.
That's true, but they still haven't. They haven't paid back yet, have they?
I think also what's on the table is not necessarily that they pay it back, but that it be deducted from future. Payments from the state.
And are they changing their processes? I mean, all back at the ranch.
I think they're required to.
See different reporting?
Probably. I mean, if there's one thing for certain in K-12 education is that they're going to change rules and change protocol, and you know, it's always a moving target. It seems like this, it's constant reform.
Right. Right. And Mark, you're still shaking your head. You just don't think it's going to happen.
I think they'll figure out some kind of deal, you know, and work it out, and everybody wins, except maybe some kids. I don't know.
Okay. There is Mark, you wrote that Republican leaders in the Ohio House say the state budget is balanced. Democrats in that chamber say it's not. I mean, I thought it was pretty well agreed that they had not sent a balanced budget to the Senate.
Well,
right?
I think. This was back when the House moved its version of the budget, and it's kind of semantics.
I guess.
I think they're according to the LS or the OBM estimates from earlier, we're $630 million to the good or whatever. That's kind of disregarding the fact that OBM has since said you need to cut at least $800 million. Or cut probably isn't the right word. You need to figure out how to deal with about $800 million less than what you had to deal with back when we made our initial projections. So this Senate President Larry Obhoff has said, you know, it's obvious we're going to have to cut some more, deal with some more of this. I wouldn't be shocked to see that $800 million number go up come June when the new estimates come out, because revenues have been trending in the wrong direction in relation to what they had originally estimated. So
had they figured out why the revenues are off? The projections, they weren't actually sure.
I was talking to a lobbyist last week who said that his theory is that one of the reasons why income tax revenues are falling is in part because they changed the rules on how small businesses, they get
sole proprietorships,
S corps or sole proprietorships, they get a big tax break. And so a lot of people who may have been independent contractors or operated differently are now, you know, forming sole proprietorships so that they can take advantage of that, and they won't have to pay as much in income taxes.
And I want to say it's up to $250,000.
Right. And then I think it's – yeah. And then I think it's
fantastic.
I think then it's like a pretty low tax rate on the remaining.
Yes.
And, you know, if you look at the business filings that are going on at the Secretary of State's office, you know, they've really gone up. And I don't know that that's because, you know, business is booming or if everybody's reorganizing to take advantage of that tax cut. So that could be one of the reasons. Mm-hmm. Also, it just seems that Ohio's economy is always like this recovery has just been kind of a slow slog for Ohio.
The Ohio miracle?
Yeah,
it's been a slow slog.
It's been a slow slog.
Okay.
I think two of the things that the governor you know, in his private time must regret is using that phrase Ohio miracle back when he was using it, which was years ago. He hasn't used it since then.
Well, he used it when he announced his candidacy for president, didn't he?
I don't think
no,
so.
I don't
maybe
think so.
He didn't.
I think
maybe
he dropped
kind
the
of...
miracle thing at least 4 or 5
okay.
years ago.
Yeah, you're right.
The
okay,
other thing is I think he probably, he must regret standing up in front of the Ohio House and saying, we may be on the verge of a recession, because every Democrat that stands up now talking about the budget says, well, the governor said we're on the verge of a recession. And, you know, he's got to regret using those words because he keeps saying it over and over. And you know, the Democrats will say, well, this budget's $400 million out of balance, you know, and the governor says we're on the verge of a recession and it's all his fault. He's got to regret using those words.
Yeah, I guess.
You know.
Or not putting more thought into it. Right.
You know, the budget does have to be balanced according to the state constitution. So even yeah. if they're using old estimates and, you know, different Medicaid counts, and there's all kinds of little games you can do to, you know, change what you're working with. But come June 30th, it's actually got to be balanced.
Hmm. I hadn't seen this before, so correct me if I'm wrong, but now the governor's saying that the $2 billion that's in the state rainy day fund, of course, Democrats, other people have thought about using it to fund programs. He says, no, we need to save it for once the budget goes into effect, there may be corrections. And I had not thought of it as something like that either. I thought it was something different that he was saving it for.
No, I think he's stuck to that line.
Okay.
What his point is, we're not going to take
for a regular
what he said
budget
is,
cycle.
Yeah, and Tim Keene, the budget director, and other people, we're not going to take any part of that $2 billion and use it, you know, as part of this budget
bill.
A new budget to balance going forward.
Gotcha.
Now, come September, October, we look at our finances. If they're down the drain, then we'll tap into it. That's the appropriate use for it, is to come back to the rainy day fund after a budget is already in process. But he says we're not going to use – they're going to tap into that to balance
the rainy day fund is actually called the budget stabilization fund, so that makes – quite a bit of sense.
Rainy
day fund is a lot easier to understand.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, the
what constitutes a rainy day isn't always clear, but
right. And you know, so a lot of people are saying that it's raining right now, that this opiate addiction crisis is a public health emergency, and that they should take some money out of the rainy day fund for that. The other thing is, you know, Ted Strickland used the rainy day fund surplus to make budget corrections midway through a budget, and the fund got drained down to 89
during the recession, of course.
And that became a huge political point that John Kasich used against Ted Strickland, and we'll still hear it. That's part of the narrative that the Kasich administration has built, and so I don't think he wants to, you know, drain the fund and leave it in the same shape that his predecessor did.
It is our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard from Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. Also with us, Mark Kovac, Ohio State House reporter for Gatehouse Media, and Jackie Borchardt, State House reporter for the Cleveland.com. We will continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Ohio State House reporter for Gatehouse Media, Mark Kovac, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff, and State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt. If you have a question or comment about what's going on down at the State House, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, and you can check the Facebook page as well. Tom Suttis wrote for the Dispatch in his column for the Dispatch that tucked into the Republican-run House's budget rewrite are amendments that could keep otherwise eligible low-income Ohioans from getting or keeping Medicaid expansion coverage. What's going on with that, Laura Bischoff?
Well, I think he's referring to a plan to require – actually, they have to get a federal waiver. They have to get the feds to sign off on this. Ohio does. But it would require people who are, I think, under 55, not in a training program, not in a recovery program. There's like all these exemptions, but basically require premiums and contribution, I think, to the equivalent of like a healthcare savings account in order to keep their Medicaid coverage. And, you know, a lot of people would say that this is a barrier to enrollment to maintaining enrollment, and that it's a veiled attempt to cut the rolls, to have fewer people on Medicaid. Now, I would think the people who support it, though, would argue that they want people to have some more personal responsibility and to make a contribution toward their health care.
And I mean, this is getting back to the Medicaid expansion disagreement that the governor has with lawmakers. We're mostly talking about what the folks who want to put some controls on this would say are able-bodied adults without children, you know, who should have a job. I mean, that's kind of the mindset, I think, that I hear over and over again. Mm-hmm. And through this kind of setup, and I believe the governor's administration pursued something like this under the Obama administration and didn't get the waiver they were seeking. But
right.
I think the thinking is, you know, as an adult, you need to get used to paying something for your care, for your benefits. So that might be $5, that might be $20, but you get used to paying something. And as you know, move up the chain and start earning more money on a career path, then you pay a little more, you pay a little more until you are no longer a part of this needy population and you're able to sustain yourself. So, I mean, what advocates, I think, would say for a move like this is, let's get these folks into jobs and used to paying something for the benefits that receiving instead of just getting handouts. That's what they would say.
And that's what Governor Kasich, he proposed last time as well, but the Republicans at the State House took it a huge step further in creating this Healthy Ohio program that Laura was talking about. And, you know, one of the points that it was eventually shot down by the feds, because if you didn't pay your premium, you missed a payment, you lost your coverage until you could, you know, repay everything that you owed. And both the Kasich administration and the federal Medicaid officials said that would just result in hundreds of thousands of people losing their coverage. And it wasn't well thought out. And so they rejected it last year. And so the fact that they put it in the budget again, that, yes, we want you to do that, you know, and that was under the Obama administration. So now that we have President Trump, you know, the thought is that it would have a better chance of passing. It's modeled off of reforms that Indiana passed. And the one of the architects of that program is now working for the federal government and would be reviewing these waivers. So, you know, all signs are pointing to better odds on that. But there's a couple other things I think that Tom Sudduss mentioned in his column that are in this budget. And one is requiring pulling out the state share of Medicaid. Medicaid is a joint program between the state and federal government. The federal government pays for most of it. But pulling out the state share for the expansion population in particular and requiring state officials to officially, formally request that funding twice a year, every 6 months, before the controlling board, which is a panel of lawmakers and the appointee from the budget office. So basically adding another level of scrutiny, another step where lawmakers can come in and say no to the funding. The Kasich administration officials are saying, well, that would, again, result in inefficiencies. It would result in people losing their coverage. To operate on a 6-month schedule like that, it just introduces way too much uncertainty into the market.
So this all came out of the House. What about the Senate? Are they amenable to this?
That remains to be seen. And my understanding is that the way that the House wrote at least the controlling board portion of this, and again, I could be wrong, but my understanding from the people I've talked to is it's written in a way that the governor couldn't line item veto it without totally eliminating the spending authority that they need for this particular spending. So I don't know if the Senate leaves it in there, or if they work out something behind the scenes, but I don't think that the governor, it would be just as simple as the governor saying, I don't agree with this, I'm going to strike this language. I think they've written it in a way so they can't do that. which means they would have to come back to the legislature at a later date to get appropriation authority to do it.
Now, some of the caveats in this, whatever came out of the House, was that if you can't show that you're in recovery, if you can't show this and that, I mean, and that's in a way a shout out to, you know, one of a couple of Kasich's concerns is people who are getting mental health treatment and people who are in recovery from opioid addiction would be spared in this process.
Right. And people, I think, also have significant medical challenges.
Okay.
So there are carve outs. You know, it's still going to be, you know, a little bit of a financial struggle for some folks who are on, they're on Medicaid because they're low income. But also, I think it's a kind of a bureaucratic hurdle as well to try to figure out how to set up this account and make your contributions and make sure you make your contributions. And
okay,
so we'll see if it stays.
Changing gears here. By the way, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. We have an email from Cynthia about Josh Mandel. She asks, are Ohio Republicans turning on Josh Mandel? Did they ever support his run for the Senate? So Josh Mandel has announced he's running for the U.S. Senate, challenging Sherrod Brown, Democrat incumbent. Also recently, they kind of slapped his wrists for slapping his face and name all over a bunch of state-funded advertising. They changed how the approval for that funding goes through in the future. Laura Bischoff, what's going on?
Yeah, Josh Mandel used $1.8 million, I think, in funds to purchase TV ads starring himself and OSU football coach Urban Meyer and a young gal from Cincinnati who has Down syndrome to promote a new program. It's kind of like a savings account for kids with disabilities. So parents can kind of sock away some money without eating into their eligibility for other benefits. And a lot of the purchases were just under $50,000, which is the threshold for controlling board approval. And they work something into the budget to kind of stymie those kind of moves. So, you know, I think that Treasurer Mandel he's been kind of an outsider in the Ohio Republican group because he endorsed like Marco Rubio for president, and then he backed Trump over Kasich. I think he backed Trump over Kasich once Rubio had backed out. And so he's kind of a little, you know, he's definitely campaigning hard for U.S. Senate. And I would be surprised if Pat Tiberi gets in and primaries him, because I think Tiberi is a little more more centrist.
But he's being very coy about it. He's not saying he is doing fundraisers, though.
Tiberi, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I mean, most members of Congress are constantly doing fundraisers.
But he has a lot.
He's got a lot. he's raising a lot of money.
That's true, they are, but he's in one of the safest seats ever created, and he's got a ton of money.
Right. So, but does he want to take on Josh Mandel in a primary? You know, usually the person to the furthest to the right in a GOP and the furthest to the left in a Democratic primary tend to attract the base, excite the base, and tend to win the primary. Mm. So I think it would be a tough race between those two.
So is the Republican Party, getting back to Cynthia's question, are Ohio Republicans turning on Josh Mandel? You're saying not necessarily. He's always been sort of outside the club.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. He kind of cuts his own path.
Yeah, and I haven't heard of any Republicans, you know,
dissing him,
yeah. Dissing is a good word, but even around the, you know, the budget language about the ads, you know, when you talk to the Republicans who sponsored that amendment, you know, they make a point to say, you know, nothing against Josh Mandel, but we just, you know, want more scrutiny and on these types of purchases, and you know, that's an opportunity for them to diss him, and they choose not to take it.
It's a different political world, and you've got Josh Mandel, who's kind of adopted the Trump rhetoric in this race,
right.
And I think given what happened in the last election, Republicans may be a little more cautious about going out and criticizing people. And so, yeah, I mean, publicly, I haven't heard any Republican really diss Josh Mandel.
There was one – I don't know what you guys think about this. Mandel vowed last week to serve only two terms in – well, in the Senate, I guess, if he's successful in unseating the Sherrod Brown. Other people say, well, he said that before. He said he would serve out his term as state treasurer, and I think a year or two into it, his first round, he was already running for the U.S. Senate.
So. Oh, I don't even think it was a year or two into it. Okay, it was about, right out of the gate.
Right out of the gate. Right.
Weeks,
okay.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. It was really fast.
Yeah. That was my shaky video, by the way,
okay.
of the former Dix newspapers, now Gatehouse Papers, our editorial board meeting when he was running for treasurer the first time. And at the very end of the editorial board meeting, I asked him, you know, what are your future plans? What are you looking at doing after this? And he said, and he didn't say, I pledge to serve my yeah. full term as treasurer. He was like, well, you know, right now I'm looking at being treasurer for 4 years, and, you know, who knows, maybe, you know, we're thinking about having a family and things may change, but, you know, right now I'm focused on being the treasurer. And so, I mean, it was
kind of like
pledge.
What they all said.
You know, it's a little different than what he did last week when he stands up and he signed. Well, the pledge that he signed technically said, I would advocate, or I would push for at the federal level for an amendment for term limits.
Uh-huh.
Now, he also verbally said, yes, I'm going to go beyond that and I'm only going to run 2 terms. But the thing he signed said, I'm going to push an amendment. But it's a lot different for him to stand up and say that specifically than in an editorial board meeting to say, yeah, I think I'll be a treasurer for 4 years. You know, is it a pledge? He did say it, you know, and it was pretty clear what he meant by it. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting that he's kind of positioning himself as this outsider, like, I'm not going to be a career politician. Actually, I think a lot of his rhetoric is anti-career politician.
Except that
he's 39 years
right.
old, and he started out in the State House in 2006, I think. So that's 11 years, and then he was on the Lyndhurst City Council before that. So, I mean, for the majority of his adult life, he's held public office.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's kind of like John Husted saying, or any of them. I mean, they all start young, and the younger they are, the more they consider themselves an outsider, but it's usually not the case.
Well, I think John Kasich is also kind of positioning himself as an outsider who's, you know, but he's been in office since he was 26 for the most part. I mean,
right, except for a few
years.
His
Lehman Brothers time.
Right.
But he hasn't been in Washington yet.
Oh, no, he was in Washington.
Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, Kasich. Back in the 90s.
Never mind. I was thinking.
Right. Yeah.
Never mind.
You're thinking
about Josh Mandel hasn't been to Washington yet.
T-Berry has a Kasich seat or whatever facsimile of that remains.
the version 2.0.
Yeah, exactly.
But Josh Mandel is definitely moving. He's very vocal about sanctuary cities. I think I think on his Twitter feed.
He went to the border.
He went to the border and talked about being, you know, being a Marine and how there was just an amount of dirt to protect him from.
On the border in Iraq.
And
a couple border agents there with him, right? He had talking with him in those videos.
Yeah, he was interviewing.
Video clips.
Some...
It's going
okay.
to be a fun race to cover.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast and a half. You had Mark Kovac, a front page story in the Dispatch today about the tax burden on Ohio farmers. You said that lawmakers are trying to address the issue. What's the problem?
Well, we're talking about CAV, current agricultural use value, and not to get too far down in the weeds. That's probably not a good way of putting it. But Ohio voters set up this system back in the early 1970s to tax farmland, essentially at a lower rate than you would for developable land. And the thought being, look, farmers are out there growing crops. We want this land to remain in cropland for agricultural uses. It's a big part of our economy, and it's important to be there. And so we've had this system in place where farmers, I mean, essentially pay less than you would pay for a residential property, a commercial property, and their property taxes. There was this combination of events in the past 4, 5, 6 years, 9 years, in that period where we've had low interest rates and we had a short period of time where farm incomes, crop prices were way up. And then farm income and crop prices tanked. But the way the formula is set up, farmers' property tax bills in some places quadrupled. And so, I mean, some farmers, one of the farmers I talked to up in the Worcester area, you know, the state's top dairy producing county, said his taxes are up something like $10,000.
Right. Why did the taxes quadruple?
Well, it's this formula, the equation that they use that takes into consideration interest rates and equity and crop prices and the way that it's set up and some of the lag time that's built into how property tax stuff works. Their property tax rates. Senator Bob Peterson, who kind of worked on this bill in the Senate and who is a farmer, said, you know, 9 years ago, if your taxes were $10,000, you know, 3 years later, they went up to $20,000. And 3 years after that, they went up to $40,000, you know. And if you had a sustained period of, you know, record high crop prices, you probably could deal with that. But now your farm incomes and stuff have gone down. But the way the formula is set up, it's not accounting for that appropriately. I mean, that's what farmers would say. Mm-hmm. And so the Farm Bureau and other agricultural groups tried to work this out, my understanding is, directly with the tax department. The tax department, you know, I think the tax department's position is this is a legislative thing. You've got to work through the legislature to get this done. Uh-huh. And so here we sit today, and the Ohio Senate moved a bill last week. The Ohio House added some CAUV reform measures into the budget. They're very similar in how they tweak the formula to try to make it more current as to, you know, the kind of conditions that farmers are dealing with. The Senate has a 3-year phase in on it. The House amendment has a 6-year phase in, and there's issues with that. So it looks like lawmakers are in a position to push something through, probably as part of the budget before the summer recess. And I mean, the farming community wants it badly. Now, the flip side of it is if you're going to do something to better control farmland, CAUV, I don't want to say CAUV values because that's redundant, but if you want to do something better to control the CAUV, in the process, you're going to have local governments and schools potentially losing anywhere between $14 and $20 million a year once it's totally phased in. Mm-hmm. And in places where you have tax issues on the books where they're fixed revenue tax levies that bring in a certain dollar amount, mm-hmm. and they adjust, if farmers are paying less in property taxes, then your residential and your other property owners are going to have to pay more. And so there's a balance there, and they're kind of working behind the scenes on the issue right now to try to deal with it. But I wouldn't be shocked to see something move before summer. The bill did pass the Senate last week unanimously, even after Senator Joe Schiavone, who is also a gubernatorial candidate, stood up and said, look, I'm really concerned about what this is going to do to school funding, and I'll have an amendment when we get around to the budget to address that, you know, to try to provide more funding to schools. Of course, that's already an issue, as we mentioned earlier, with the budget stuff.
It just seems like another chapter in the trying to avoid Robin Peter to pay Paul scenario down at the State House. Laura Bischoff?
Exactly. I mean, if I'm glad that Mark was able to explain that, because it was kind of hanging out there in my mind when it came out in the budget amendments of, you know, if the farmers are going to pay less, then somebody else has got to pay more, or we do with less money in the schools. And so the downstream effect of that is what I'd be interested in knowing more about, like who's going to end up having to pay more.
Yeah, who are the winners and losers?
Right.
Yeah.
But if you're a farmer, I mean, think about it. I've got my farm field. You know, I may have some dairy cows out there, and if my taxes are have gone up $20,000, I might start thinking about, okay, maybe I'll just develop that 1,000 acres into houses, because I can make a whole lot more money and I can move to Florida and whatever. You know, and if they do that in a place like Wayne County, you know, the biggest dairy producing county in the state, I mean, suddenly you're changing the landscape of the rural areas. You're requiring more services to serve those places, you know, emergency services.
Who wants to live out Wayne County? I mean,
who wants to live out Wayne County? It's God's country.
I'm not knocking Wayne County, but development usually has to follow some sort of logic. Like, there has to be a demand for housing there.
Well, I mean, certainly we've seen a lot of prime agricultural land in counties that, you know, border big cities like Delaware County,
well, of course,
Warren
exactly.
County.
Right.
You know, people are they're willing to drive a long ways to work if they can have a nice big house on a big lot. So mm-hmm.
Yeah, drive up 315 to Delaware.
Yeah.
I mean, you got those huge houses out in the middle of what was once prime cropland.
Right.
You know, I mean, people are willing to spend
the
money.
What's near Wayne County?
What's that?
What's near Wayne County?
What's near Wayne County?
He's drawing a blank.
Well, there's
the county seat of Wayne County.
There's industry there, Worcester Brush Company.
It's up in Northeast Ohio.
Up in Northeast Ohio. What's the company that makes the hand sanitizer? Purell, is that the
Purell?
Name?
Purell.
Hey, the Purell right there. They just put a factory there. Daisy brand milk products. You have all kinds of food processing. You got Gerber chicken factories. Don't even get me started.
This man knows Wayne County.
He does.
I was farm editor up there before I came down here.
I touched a nerve.
There you go.
I touched the farm editor nerve.
People would drive from Akron or whatever to go live out in the country.
Ultimately, though, the demise of agricultural land in Ohio, it's a big deal. What percentage of Ohio's industry or economy is wrapped up in agriculture?
Folks would say it's our number one industry if you account for food processing and all the stuff that goes into it and comes out of it. So, I mean, we're talking billions.
Yeah, exactly. We will continue our conversation, our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard from Mark Kovac, Ohio State House reporter for Gatehouse Media. Also with us, Jackie Borchardt of Cleveland.com and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Office of Ohio Auditor, State Auditor, I should say, Dave Yost, reports that spending on IT personal services has more than doubled since 2011-2012. State spending now hits $452 million a year, while the number of less expensive state employed IT people has dropped. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. Still with us, Ohio State House reporter for Gatehouse Media, Mark Kovac, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News, Laura Bischoff, and State House reporter for Cleveland.com, Jackie Borchardt. Questions, comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Usually Republicans particularly say that private contracts like this are more efficient, they're more cost efficient. What's the deal? Laura Bischoff?
Well, first off, full disclosure, my husband is an IT worker
for
the state of Ohio.
Okay.
This has been an issue for as long as I've been a reporter covering state house news, which is like 16 years.
And we're talking about the larger privatization, I guess, of state services.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes the state has to replace like some major legacy system, some giant infrastructure system, and they'll hire IT companies to come in and do, you know, the real heavy lifting on a giant project. The number – Randy Ludlow has been the lead reporter on this from the Dispatch and has broken the story about DAS doing unbid contracts with former associates. You know, DAS is the Department of Administrative Services. It's the purchasing arm for the state. And then he followed it up on Sunday with this story about, how the number of IT professionals in state government has – over the last 5 years – dropped by 330, so now there's like 1,500 IT workers. And in the meantime, the IT consulting professional services bill, the tab for that is like $452 million a year, up from $207 million in 11-12. Some of that might be inflationary costs.
That's just 5 years ago, though.
Right. But, I think that this has been a major issue. The union has constantly complained that it is not cheaper to hire these big companies to come in and write some big system for you. Like, it's the state does have an enormous amount of projects always going, and so they could constantly have their own IT people doing it at a lesser cost. Some of the
even with state benefits.
Sure. I mean, some of the contractors getting paid $200 an hour.
Right.
Randy's story said that an experienced IT worker makes about $95,000 a year or $47 an hour. So,
I mean, it kind of makes you wonder about they're talking about going, you know, has ballooned to $452 million. If they could chop that in half, that's a chunk of change right there.
Sure.
To save money. But how are state lawmakers responding to this? I mean, this is coming out of the state auditor's office, right?
Right. Well, they did also put an amendment into the House version of the budget that would require, again, for the third time, we're talking about controlling board.
I was going to say it's become the most popular date in town.
Yeah, they're no longer a little known panel, as Mark Kovac likes to call them. But it would require, again, some more. These IT contracts would need to be presented before the controlling board. Most of them aren't for a variety of reasons. And so they're trying to rein it in at that level. But I haven't heard anything yet about cutting or stopping these things. I mean, from the state's point of view, these are necessary upgrades, software upgrades or new software that needs to be the state's basically all their digital processes for doing all of these jobs that the state does are outdated or aging. And these upgrades are necessary.
And they're going to continue to be necessary going into the future.
Right. And also, you know, when you might pay a lot upfront to have a brand new fancy system built for what you need to do, but then the maintenance of it is cheaper.
There could be a very reasonable explanation for all this. But, I mean, my favorite line from Randy's first story was where he was bringing this up and he was trying to get answers. And how did the state respond? I think it was something like, well, this issue is not conducive to an interview or something to that extent.
They wouldn't do an interview.
You know, you've got an investigative reporter with documents to back him up coming to you to say, explain this. That's the last thing you tell somebody because it doesn't look good and it all smells really bad, even if it's not.
Right.
You know, it just seems like a bad way to handle it.
Yeah, but it threw some gasoline on the fire. Laura Bischoff, you spent Friday in Kirkersville.
Yes.
Horrible tragedy there.
It was terrible.
It's not necessarily a typical topic for us, but five people died. Was it?
Four.
Okay.
Right. So the this guy, Thomas Heartless, was his name, with a long criminal history, a lot of domestic violence, assault, had kidnapped a previous girlfriend. He broke up with a nurse who worked at this nursing home, broke up with him and got protective orders against him. He went after her and the police chief, who was on the job for just like 3 weeks and father of six with one on the way. He was responding to a report of a man with a gun in the street. And so he goes out on that call and comes across Heartless, who had taken two bystanders hostage in a little wooded area off an alley behind the nursing home. And, the last radio transmission they had from him was that he had the man with the gun in his sights. Heartless, shot and killed the police chief, Stephen Eric DeSario. And then, forced his way into the nursing home and killed his ex-girlfriend and a nurse's aide. And then I don't know if the police have confirmed this or if it's just suspected that he turned the gun on himself.
Yeah, I think that's what they've said.
Right. So this is just a terrible, domestic violence with additional victims.
Tell us about Kirkersville a little bit.
So it's a small town. There's a couple of churches, a thrift shop. It is in Southwest Licking School District. They have a great cross-country meet out there at Watkins.
That's right, Watkins Memorial.
But it's a real small town, and I think maybe 500 people in the village. The police department really is just a couple of part-timers. They rely mostly on the Licking County Sheriff's Department for patrols.
It looked like from the photos that kind of the whole town was sort of cordoned off and shut down.
Yeah, the main street was shut down, which I think that might be U.S. 40. But anyway, yeah, it was shut down pretty much all day. A lot of media there. And then a lot of the, you know, I think the town folks, most of them, you know, knew people who worked at the nursing home. I talked to one gal. Her dad was a letter carrier, and he came out to he was a letter carrier in Zanesville, and he got word. She texted while she was hiding in the basement, and he left his job to, you know, rush to Kirkersville, and she found his daughter was okay. And I ran into them at the Denny's. I was taking a quick lunch break, and so I talked to the gal. And she said she's 23 years old. She's been working there since she was a junior in high school. And I said, well, what were you thinking when you were, you know, what did you hear? She said, well, I heard banging, loud bangs, but I thought it's a behavioral facility. So I thought somebody was just throwing a chair or something.
Uh-huh.
And one of her coworkers went up the stairs and they came right back down and said, somebody's got a gun, somebody's shooting. And they barricaded the door, called 911, said they had to keep calm. And I said, well, what was running through your mind? And she said, I just thought I have to keep these people safe. I got to keep that door shut. It's terrifying.
Right. And so sad about the police chief. I mean, 3 weeks on the job, as you said.
Yeah. And, you know, I think the nurse's aide who was killed, she had 5 kids, I believe. So, I mean, you just look at the damage and the tragedy for so many people.
Now, this guy wasn't supposed to have a firearm, right?
Oh, I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, he only served, I think, 8 months in prison for that abduction
which was certainly not enough time to deal with mental health issues or whatever.
Or whatever was going on with him. Yeah, yeah. I think in the application for protective order, the ex-girlfriend was saying, I'm surprised, I can't remember her name. I think it was Melina. Anyway, she was describing how she just felt like she couldn't help him anymore, and that he wasn't staying on his meds, and that he was, you know, explosively angry.
Which he had a history of, as you mentioned, taking another ex-girlfriend hostage.
Right.
At one point.
Right. So he was convicted of abduction, and I think he got a longer sentence, but I think he only served like 8 months.
Very sad. Well, thanks. Thanks for telling us about that. We just have about a couple minutes left. What's coming up this week? Is it just still budget work? What?
Lots of budget work. Lots of committee hearings.
Yeah, going the Senate.
On.
The Senate's got the budget, and they're going full steam ahead, listening to testimony on all of its myriad components.
They've got about 6 weeks to work with this. Well, no, more like 4.5 or 5 weeks, maybe. I guess.
I think Senate President Obhoff is shooting, he said, for like a mid-June date.
Okay, and, a month away then.
And I think that's why we've heard more from the Senate on being more proactive in trimming the spending down ahead of that. Because in June, then they'll get the final budget projections that's going back to the semantics issue. That's what they'll be tied to as to did they balance the budget or not.
Semantics. It's just semantics.
It'll be a fairly abbreviated time at that point, though.
Yeah.
The time the Senate moves,
right.
They've got to get through conference
right.
committee.
So by trying to do that before that comes, then hopefully it won't be as big of a surprise or you won't have to get the big knives out.
Well, Jackie Borchardt, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie Borchardt of thecleveland.com, Mark Kovac of Gatehouse Media. Thank you so much.
Have a good week.
And Laura Bischoff for the Dayton Daily News. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.